right, and welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Snack Time with Mike and Ant. I'm one of your co-hosts, Ant Testator, a freelance writer of names and flavor text for Wizards of the Coast and a writer for Gathering Magic. Man, I'm stumbling a little bit today.
Just struggle is real today.
The struggle is so real.
I'm the middle part of the ant sandwich that is today, Mike Linneman. I'm the Vorthos Mike, if you will. And I also used to write the flavor text and do the naming. I also work as an art director for a little stint there. And today, on a special episode of the Snack Time cast, we have a guest with us, the concept artist extraordinaire, among other things. I think he has 15 slashes on skills and proficiency he has. And that is the second ant in the Mike sandwich, Ant Scott Waters, Anthony Scott Waters.
Greetings. Greetings to both of you and the world at large.
We're in it. So for those of people that don't know, Ant, who are you? Like, you're an artist. Where are you from? What's the background in art? What got you started out?
According to Mom, since my memory doesn't go back far enough to state this, I have to lean on Mom's experience. I started drawing when I was very, very young. And I've just been told since I could hold a pencil. Thank you, Mom.
That was excellent.
Guest appearance by Corinne Waters.
author of
Anthony Waters. Let's see, I have had an abiding interest in art for as long as I can remember, and I think the period that had its greatest effect on me was, do you remember the artist Star Wars books that were...
Oh, I have.
Big? Are we talking Hildebrand?
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Probably the most formative movie on my personality was Star Wars. And when I got those books, Art of Star Wars, Art of Empire Strikes Back, Art of Return of the Jedi,
right,
it blew my mind that you could draw a world into existence and paint a world into existence. And that became something I very much wanted to do. I got sidetracked by animation, because I love traditional Western style animation. And I don't know, shortly after coming out of animation school in the mid 90s, I got a chance to do some concept art, and my mind went right back to that, back to the 9 or 10 year old who pored over those books. And and I've never looked back. Never look back.
All right. Well, we got a boatload of questions today, and we'd love to hear, you know, top to bottom, all the juicy, flavorful goodness and juicy things that we can sponge up for as long as we can get you.
Okay.
To start out, all of our casts, we always start with a flavor gem, and I'll go first in this just to get you kicked off. Show you how we do this. And since we're trying to talk a little bit more about concept art and the things behind that, I'm going to mention the card Gavany Township. And this card, it's a land. It adds just a single color to your mana pool, and it has an ability for 2, a green and a white. You tap it, and you put a +1/+1 color on each creature you control. It's made by Peter Moorbacher, and it's for the Innistrad set. And why I chose this card is... One, it's a beautiful piece. It's just a big, great house of this town hall in Gavany. And for the Innistrad set, it was based on Prussia, which is, you know, 1700s, 1800s, Germany, Poland, Czech mixed in. And this idea of this town hall, the Rathaus, if you know you're German, I grew up in Germany until I was about 5. So this style of architecture brings me back to being a little kid. Every time I see this card being played by whoever in, you know, some random deck, I immediately think of myself as this little, you know, German boy wearing my overalls chasing pigeons. Because there's always pigeons by a town hall. Why wouldn't there be, right? There's like ice cream shop, coffee shop, and pigeons. Like, that's straight up like German City every time.
Wow.
So every time I see this image, I'm like, I damn you, Pete, why do you have to work digitally? It makes me want to just shake the hell out of him. This is the type of art that my family has in, you know, our homes, and it hasn't changed since the medieval times. It just, this is what the cities look like. So by having this, he could have taken a photograph and really said, okay, how can I make this relevant and feel like a magical world, but yet still grounded in reality of this nod wink if you get what he's showing you. And for me, it's doubly important because it's my childhood.
Awesome. And it really is a gorgeous card.
It's utterly beautiful. Even the perspective is cool, so you feel like you're on the ground and you're looking upward at it like a little kid.
Yeah, he's a tremendous painter.
He's super good at this.
Really tremendous painter.
All right, next up, obviously, is one of the ants.
Which ant will go first?
I would rock, paper, scissors you, but I can't get my camera to work. So
he's not wearing pants. He never does.
That's a cast secret, Mike. You need to save, Mike, you need to save something for our behind-the-scenes episode. Jeez.
Yeah, I know. We're going to have, like, an all-video podcast one of these days. And like, wow, you guys both have mustaches.
So the one I got first today is Bribery. This is a sorcery from the Mercadian Masks set. And so this card hits for me on almost – excuse me, almost every level that a card kind of can as far as flavor, because it has a beautiful one-word name that perfectly sums up what the card does. The flavor text is a world-building piece that says, in Mercadius City, loyalties extend only as far as your purse can stretch, which perfectly sums up the whole kind of like backstabbing political plane that Mercadia was. And on top of all of that, the art has this really nice, and Mike, I'm going to steal a word from you, has a very nice painterly quality to it that I really appreciate. So, and since we're getting really personal with our flavor gems today after Mike, ever since I first started playing Magic and D&D and really got into the whole fantasy genre, which of all the genres is my favorite, even though I love Star Wars very much. And science fiction, for me, fantasy is kind of like where it's always been, and it really hit home. And I am a sucker for anything that has to do with subtlety and assassins and rogues and backstabbing and thieves and that whole kind of piece of the fantasy genre. So this card for me is perfect because not only does it encapsulate that in its flavor, but when I play it in the game, I feel like I'm backstabbing my opponent and stealing their best thing and then destroying them with it. And what's funny is, and I don't know if you happen to be listening, but at PAX East, I played this card against someone who wanted to play me in a game, and I looked through his deck and I stole his Thraxamundar and I totally decimated with it, and I did not feel bad at all.
Nice.
Victory should never make you feel sad.
It was so good.
It should never embarrass you. Round for humility, maybe, but you know, just no. It should always make you feel happy. And I love Andrew Robinson's work. This is somebody that Doug Alexander Gregory introduced me to years ago. And I'm not sure what he's doing right now. I think he's doing video game design, but he's got a kind of a graphic quality meshed with a little bit of an acid trip. Like some of the pieces that he did for, and this is going way back, but going like Tempest and Stronghold, some of the images he would paint had a lovely, lush painted quality, but then he'd do things like stretch the faces, either using Photoshop, or I think he was using real media at that point, so maybe a Xerox copier, so that he'd have these beautiful hands on the figure and the face would be accurate, right? It would read like a human face, a reasonable human face, except it's been distorted such that it's like a face you'd see in a dream.
So it's almost like an uncanny valley when a robot looks a little too real and you're like, mind kind of checks in and out and like, wait, no, that's a painting. No, it's not.
Yep. And deliberately messing with your head.
Yeah.
in that sense. I love that kind of thing.
Yeah, and that kind of, it brings like a nice otherworldly feel to it. So where you can look at this and think like, you know, oh, these are human-esque, but really they exist on some far off plane. So it only makes sense that maybe their proportions are a little different than they would be here.
Or it's a, you know, imagine a magical fantasy world in which taking an acid trip changes you physically.
Right, that's true.
It messes with your head. Right.
What I really like about and some of his pieces, they have this kind of like this texture thing to them where it almost looks like they're painted on a wall somewhere. Like someone mm-hmm. just walked up to a mural in like what could be a really cool version of like the Sistine Chapel where there's pictures of, you know, bribery and whatnot, and they just kind of snapped a photo of it and put it on a card.
Oh, it's a beautiful piece of art. That's all I can say.
Yeah. All right. So, what do you got for us, Ant? Guest Ant, if you
guest
will.
Ant.
What do you got that you can give us some little fun insight into?
I'm going to go for Yavimaya Coast.
Hey.
Okay. Yavimaya Coast was one of two pieces of art that I did for the latter end of the Urza Saga set, Urza's Destiny, that were not originally going to be cards. They were concept art that I did that turned into cards. And so there's I'm going to hit this on two levels. The first is the adult, mature, intellectual brain, and the other is the seven-year-old, haha, I did this, and this is incredible. Look at what I did, Mom. We'll start with the intellectual.
Sure.
at this point, we're talking about right before the invasion of Dominaria, right? We've got a planet that's already had some pretty awful things happen to it. We know that an invasion is coming. And while I was working with the team, talking a lot with Scott McGough and with Pete Venners, it gradually became clear that they wanted one place on the planet that it's almost as if the planet had a Gaia principle attached to it, a spirit, and that spirit had poured all this energy into one organic point. And that organic point was going to give birth to a variety of creatures, a whole ecosystem designed to take down Phyrexians.
Ah, cool.
And they wanted that to be an island. They wanted it to be the island of Yavimaya, and they handed it to me.
Nice.
And go! Go.
this is where I live. This is the kind of thing that just gets me incredibly excited.
That's magical Christmas land 101.
It is. It's a fantasy environment, so I get to play with magic, but I also get to play with biology. I get to play with geology.
Right.
And I get to start world building. And a bunch of the stuff that I sent you was directly related to this, because I started thinking about, well, what sort of things would you, if you knew as a godlike entity that this power was coming towards you, and you had a rough sense of what sort of things this power could do and what its potential weaknesses were, what would you make? What would you grow? And so I came up with this idea of, even though it's a functional biome with all of the things that you might expect in a biome, I used as a reference point the island of Papua New Guinea. If you know anything about Papua New Guinea, it's a very mountainous environment. Yep. And one of the incredible things about Papua New Guinea is that it has what are called microclimates. Every valley is ecologically different from the valley next to it.
Right.
And I'm talking seriously different. It can be radically different. One valley.
I mean, they have volcanoes there, and then they have, like, reefs. It's crazy.
Yeah, and then crazy cliffs that go right down to the ocean. So you have some places that are more like the shores of, I don't know, Scotland or Newfoundland.
Yep.
So it's this huge variety of places. So, all right, we're going to have Yavimaya like that. Because that way it is a huge biofoundry. When the Phyrexians finally do come, Mother Nature has at least six options to throw at them. And whichever one works will get the chance to populate the island, right? And at the very least, if that stops working, you've got other fallbacks you can lean on.
Interesting.
So this world, we start out at the ground level, the plants, right? The plants and the trees. The trees I designed around constriction, around snakes. So take your average redwood and turn it into a 215 or 300 foot long coil of muscle. These things are, that's the reason why the trees in those environments are all, they look like big piles of rope.
Yeah, they do. They almost look like worms or something.
They're designed so that they can react to the environment and they can bind to each other and form walls and redoubts and restrict areas so that, for example, if you need to have an area open, like a plain area, so that you can have a killing zone, the trees can link up and create a barrier to open up a space and to provide a wall so that you can push your enemy into that open space and they end up against a wall and you can kill them all.
Oh, wow.
They're also...
That's super
neat. Yeah, that is awesome.
Like, that is crazy ridiculous to say, like, well, the trees aren't really alive, but, you know, they move and they have this ridiculous strategic advantage. Like, oh, I never really thought of that.
Yeah, like, oh, you need a choke point? Well, here you go. Like, or you need a crazy rope tendril of trees that just grow up the coast so that no ships can dock here? Awesome. Done. We can do that.
Exactly. Exactly.
Cool. Okay, very good.
It extends underground too, so that the entire island has almost a waterway or a subterranean canal system that functions almost like peristaltic action.
Right. So the roots can do it. The roots can also do it. Awesome.
So you can. So if you can get like on the back of a big turtle and go shooting through these passages of water that's being pushed around underneath the island at, you know, 50 feet, 200 feet down. But then you get to the coast, right? And the coast it's not necessarily where your most ferocious defenses are. That's where your sacrificial defenses are, because you want to pull your enemy in and wipe them out inside so that the enemy thinks, hey, we get out there, hey, that was easy. We got a beachhead now. And then we can plow in. Or we can bark at the dog that goes by. Careful. You just never know. Because even though they look cute, they're probably bastards. And they're probably out to get mom's CD player and her TV. And yes, sweetheart, I know. They're ferocious labs. They're horrible, horrible creatures.
So difficult.
And you are so good. You are so ferocious and good. And I'm so proud of you. And now you can shut up. You really can.
All right. Well, that's a fantastic.
That's enough, Sweet Pea. That's enough. All right. I think we are back to the land of the living. So I came up with images that reflected all these different areas of the island. And I was asked to produce something for a coastline. And I started thinking about how you would defend a coastline if you were a giant godlike Mother Nature creature. And I thought about what I knew about Normandy during World War II, the defensive systems that Erwin Rommel built. And one of the defensive systems that he came up with that was relatively cheap and easy to deploy were these weird tinker toy things made out of rebar and concrete. Right. They look like tinker toys or
jacks.
Or,
they look like jacks. Yeah.
But they're totally designed to destroy ships. Right? You have a landing ship, it gets hung up on one of those, and you're way far out from, you know, at least ideally, you're away from the coast. You can't, you know, people jump out of the ship, they're going to drown.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, we've zoned in, we've got all our guns figured out, the range figured out, all these places, so we can turn that into a killing zone.
Right, right.
In this case...
It's like Saving Private Ryan, that's one of the opening, isn't that one of the opening scenes, right?
It is. It is. It's the one that caused so many vets to have
flashbacks.
Flashbacks.
Right, right.
And it's an incredible sequence. But in this case, The island makes its defenses out of these really strong barbed roots. And so it kind of looks like a mangrove swamp when you first come on it. You've got these weird hoops of barbed roots that are coming out of the ground. And the idea would be you'd land and you'd start moving in and gradually the roots would start waking up. It's like, hey, something's on top of me. What am I supposed to do when something is on top of me? I wrap around it until I break it apart or until I get torn up. And I drew some illustrations of, you know, Phyrexian robots going in there and getting messed up. And they liked it so much that they said, could you paint this? And it's not often that Mark or Anson or I got to take a concept that was going to simply be in the style guide. It was going to be for other artists to develop and take it all the way through to a card.
Right. Okay, so that was actually rare.
It was very rare. If you're talking characters, right, Urza, any of the other major characters of that cycle, we had turnarounds for all those characters. We had a variety of outfits for all those characters to wear. And so it was pretty restrictive. If you got to paint, oh, I don't know, Urtai or Miri, it was expected that you were going to hit a certain mark. But we went nuts with the environment so that we could hand that over to the artist as broad general points. Hey, the creatures that we've come up kind of look like this. Creatures that we've invented kind of look like this. The plants we've invented kind of have this feel. Go and play.
Yeah.
And some people, it was the best of both worlds because some people like having a roadmap that's very very exact. Right. So they don't have to think too much.
Right.
It means that the painting can be done quickly and executed beautifully. They can follow their system and crank it out and it'll be beautiful. Other people, they really want to be able to use their imaginations. And in this case, we've created something that just points them in a direction. And that was part of the pleasure of being on that team is cranking out the style guide. And then 6 weeks later, these paintings start coming in that take our concepts and make them look insanely good. I mean, better than certainly I could ever make them look. And it's a wonderful feeling to have been able to take something all the way through from beginning to end.
It's like you're playing Inception with all of them.
Yeah.
I mean, really.
Well, except for the shooting in the head part.
Well, there's that entire thing.
I just pulled up the, you know, the high res version of Yavimaya Coast, and I never noticed before that the bark has these tiny little, it almost looks like quills or barbs or like just something enough that if you were to brush by it, like I would think that my clothes would get kind of caught in it, or it just has this appearance of like that it would be like Velcro, like just really difficult to maneuver through it.
Yeah,
it's really interesting.
It's crazy level of detail.
Yeah,
thank you. Very cool. First few steps would be just fine.
Yeah, right. Interesting. These plants are moving around.
All right. So going into this concept idea, obviously there's a crazy amount of background information tied up in singular visual images. I mean, granted, if you have a style guide, you have pages and pages to explain, oh, this tree has this significance and it has, you know, this importance and this backstory and this storyline significance. But how does this concepting for a game maybe differ from, say, a movie or a video game or maybe even a fiction book that you're making maybe on Kickstarter or something of this sort? I mean, is concept art kind of the same in all of these different mediums, or does it differ slightly?
It varies depending on who the client is.
Okay.
And I would extend that deliberately to the level of personality, the level of individuals. For example, there are a few folks out there in the movie industry who are still very, very old school. Guillermo del Toro is one of them.
Dude's got a sketchbook that looks awesome.
Oh, it does.
Oh, man, those are so cool.
Oh, and
Books.
if you want a serious treat, look up, if you haven't seen them already, look up some of the concept art for Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah.
And
Oh,
you'll see some
yeah.
absolutely incredible concept art. It is, to me, it's at its best when you are working with someone like Del Toro. I'm trying to think of another person who would be a good example. I think it was Frank Oz who directed Dark Crystal, and he got to work with Brian Froud.
Sure.
In these instances, the person who's running the show knows what your strengths are and just cuts you loose, says, I need something like this. I need something that has a feeling like this, or I have an environment like this. George Lucas was, he had some similarities to Del Toro in that he painted with an extremely broad brush. He would, according to what I've read, he'd go in and talk with Ralph McQuarrie or Norman Reynolds and say, you know what, I think I want a big space battle.
Yeah.
And then he'd walk out.
Yeah. They
Then
talk
just
about that
peace
in
out.
the they talk
Yes.
about in the doc the documentary that they just released for their they just released everything on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
And they literally talk about, I think it's almost exactly what you said, where he would walk in and say, like, yeah, I'm thinking about like swords, but they're lasers. And you would literally, that was the meeting adjourned. And it's like, I'll be back tomorrow with my little stamp. And I'll pick one of the 10 that you come up with, or
Yeah,
something like that.
give me my laser sword.
Yeah, or like
And
tomorrow it's Lava Planet. Go.
I mean the ideal environment for a concept artist. I mean, all of us dream of that kind of setting. Most of the time, the client has pretty specific, they've got pretty specific ideas about what they want.
Okay, so
And
what would be an example of that? I mean, you don't have to name names, but like, what would be an example of, like, I have a monkey world and I need pants for them to figure out? Like, I
I would say
don't know.
the best example would be if you were concepting for, say, a high concept commercial, say for the commercials that they show during the Super Bowl,
Right.
you are probably going to be working with a very high-end director, Ridley Scott or Ang Lee or someone like that, and they will have very specific ideas of what they want. And they will drive you. No, I don't like that monster's head. I need it to be more like blah. And so you give them blah. It's like, okay, now you need to make the body more like X. I've heard that James Cameron is very much that way.
Okay.
You are stuck with someone like that because he can direct and he can write. Oh, and he also can really paint and draw. So he knows what he's going to ask for. And he's going to be able to describe it fairly accurately, and we're now crossing the line into, are you more comfortable being someone who is effectively a pair of hands, or someone who really wants, you come to me because my gift is building things.
Right.
Maybe a better, I think a better way, a less derogatory way, because I'm thinking there's some might take that in a pejorative way. Are you more challenged by trying to figure out the vibe that your client is going for through what they're telling you to do? Or are you more interested in an environment where the client says, here's a blank space, please fill it?
Which you don't have to go
So,
into sometimes fine detail with the
yeah.
high level. Fill us in. It's like, well, okay, you don't need to think about an ecosystem there all the way. It's kind of like this, and then you go from there.
Yeah, it's broad brush. In games, often you are limited by, and understandably limited by, two factors, game engine and game mechanics.
Right. So Ant, let me ask you this. On the scale of, total freedom, George Lucas, to being an extra pair of hands, James Cameron, where does magic fall as far as like their
Oh,
level
boy.
of control and
Well,
detail?
and there's probably two even things in that, like magic concept art when there are a bunch of dudes on staff, and then like design pushes now.
Things have changed since I was on the team, but those 2 years, 97 to 99, were two of the most exciting years artistically of my life. And I still look back on them fondly because we were let loose. And we came up with all sorts of wacky stuff. And for the most part, we just got the nod. A lot of the stuff that Mark created, I mean, we were stablemates, right? We were literally cube to cube.
And Mark
Tadeen, the fabulous Mark Tadeen.
Yeah.
Mark Tadeen, the machine.
yeah, what is that like? I mean, what's that like to work next to him?
Just like concept artists, whenever they work, there's not just one good one and a bunch of interns around. Like, these are wizard among high level wizards hanging out. Eating Indian food at lunchtime and then pounding stuff out.
Mark was he was someone I had enormous respect for beforehand because I had a chance to work with him and Anson on a couple of other projects doing some concept work. And so I kind of knew what I was setting myself up for, but even so, it was intimidating at first. And even when we got to the point where we were friends, the best thing about it was his level of expertise and his imagination was a constant pressure on me to up my game. And I, just like the paintings that came in afterwards were a constant pressure on me to up my game. I stopped painting for magic for a year when I saw Mark Zug's piece. You guys can help me with the name because I'm spacing it right now, but it's it depicts a moment of detente between a Vec general and I think either an elven or a merman dude and a third person. It's got a guy holding his hand to his chest in sort of a peacemaking gesture. And when that painting came in, I wish I could remember the name of the card. When that painting came in, my jaw hit the ground. It was so beautifully painted. Just the skill level put my jaw on the ground, but the emotional content of the painting too was so powerful that I looked at my own work and went, oh God, I've got to get better. I cannot face myself if I am not at least able to feel like, all right, I I'm not at that level, but I'm getting there.
I think I know what art this is. I think the card is Oath of Lieges.
That sounds right.
There's a back general. There's four people standing around. One is touching his chest. There's a green flag behind him.
That's the one.
That's the one. It's the figures are just beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. These are the three. They're the three. What, the Ilkor, the Envec? They're like the three races of Wrath, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, the three races.
Yeah.
Getting ready to combine forces, right? Getting together to pledge an oath to each other. And yes, that painting is about, I want to say it's about not quite 2 feet by a foot and a half.
I don't think that too many people know that the early magic art is tiny. I mean, it's 4 inches by 6 inches. It's so small. And then Mark Zuck was like, I'm going to paint big. Is that cool with you guys? I'm gonna make it real big, and you're like, "Oh my god!"
we got someone buy a scanner.
Not OG and Cola, they worked and Todd Lockwood, they worked big, and then you would get people like Michael Sudfin, who's that's maybe 200, 300. Well, it's about 300%, which means it's like a little bit bigger than a postcard.
Yeah, it's just, is so small.
It's tight as a vice.
Can you imagine that his back must have been sore all the time?
I thought at the time, it's like, this guy has to have glasses as thick as Coke bottles. We would all be clustered around his paintings going, how did he, Jesus, this guy, he must be blind by now. But Zug was very different. He had one of the things you can't readily see online is that he'll do a lot of jewel tones by getting a blob of red, and he'll pop a little bit of green next to it. Or he'll have a lot of yellow in an area, but he'll pop in some little lavenders, little blobs of lavender in there. hearkening back to the pointillists, people like George Seurat, who were just beginning to figure out how the eye registers color.
Yeah.
And it creates this, when you see the original, it creates this beautiful sort of scintillance almost. It's almost like the painting is vibrating, and it's gorgeous to see.
Like, and if there's a magic art exhibition to happen, mm-hmm. anytime, there needs to be a few of Mark Zug's pieces in there.
Absolutely.
No question.
Yeah, without question. A few of his, a few of Dermot Powers. There's another guy who we need to see some of his stuff. Definitely some Donato paintings.
Yeah, I have a Donato on my wall, and it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable how much he gets in there. I have his archivist piece that came out in 7th edition. And it's just, you know, normal figure standing in front of a painting, inside a painting. And you're like, my God, man.
Yep. Yep. Here's a guy who is employed now largely to, paint portraits.
Yeah.
Like, for people who have lots of money.
Yeah. I saw his giant, what was it, like 15 feet by 8 feet Lord of the Rings image. And I'm like, my God. God, man, how much paint does that just simply take?
Oh, yeah. One of my favorite Dean Cola stories. A friend of mine, Doug Alexander, was on a magic tour with him in South America. And they were on to the last day and had, you know, Doug had figured they were going to go hang out. They were going to go bounce around and have some fun. And
right.
He came into the event saying, I'm really sorry, man, I'm going to have to take off. Doug's like, why? Why is that? Oh, there's a guy who's the head of some corporation who wants his portrait painted. And I'm going to need, you know, to get prepped for that. So I'm going to have to take off right away. And then he shared, which I won't at this point, but he then shared the amount of money that he was going to get for this portrait. And let's just say some people earn that amount of money in a year.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, just like, oh my God.
need to go now.
Yeah, I'm going to go paint Henry Ford's portrait. I'll see you
later.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so, oh
but my this God. Is, yeah, this is, this was one of the magical things about working at WOTC for this period is you can get a lot accomplished. You can grow quite a bit as an artist on your own. Just especially with the internet now, you can have a community, bounce your art off of people and see if it sticks or if it falls to the floor, get their opinions and their advice. But there is nothing at all like being in the same room with a bunch of people of similar minds and skill sets and working with them day in and day out. It's an experience that everyone should have. If concept art or illustration is something that is really your fire, then try and find a group of people who have a similar fire and at least get together with them once a week and spend an evening drinking beer and drawing.
It's like the live drawing sessions, which, you know, you see people every now and then be like, yeah, it was great for the first hour. Second hour, art just turned out like crap.
Yep. Yep.
You know, after doing a live drawing, or they hire a model for the night or whatever.
Is that what you would get, like, if there was an upcoming, you know, like a student out there or an upcoming artist who wanted to get into the concept game, is that what you'd recommend? Just like find a solid group that you can all just kind of paint together and feed off of each other?
I would say any kind of artist. If you want to, especially in the commercial industry, it's a little different in the fine art industry, but the place where there's crossover and the reason why it's really important if you're going into commercial art is, you know, we talked earlier about the needs of clients. It's a job.
Yeah.
Your task is to make other people's dreams pretty. And one can very quickly forget what it was like when you were 7 years old and had the pencils in your hand and were drawing dragons attacking fighters and loving every minute of it and dreaming of knights riding mechanized horses and or you know, inventing the plot for the next Gundam movie or something.
Awesome.
You've got to be able to hold on to that little kid inside who just wants to come up with stories and invent fantastic places. Otherwise, you will hit a point in your life where you can do the work, but you don't want to anymore. You don't love it anymore.
You almost lose the joy, the whimsy.
Oh, yeah.
That comes from it.
Oh, yeah. Because the truth of the matter, when people say, we love your work and we want you to work for us, it's very easy for an artist to hear, oh, my God, you love me. You want me to contribute. And they do. They want you to contribute your skills to make their ideas look good.
Which has got to be super humbling, too, to be like, oh. But almost like reaffirming every now and then, like, oh, I am in the right field. I actually know what the hell I'm doing. And people actually like that. Oh, okay, let's make some cool stuff.
In that, it's always nice to get the pat on the head, no matter what. You know, just like, oh, yeah, you are awesome. You do this really well. It's like, yes, I do.
Hell yes. Because
most of the time you don't. Most of the time it's like, God damn it, this painting isn't working again. I know how to do this. Why isn't this working?
Right.
When you're in there by yourself talking to a dog and the dog can't speak back to you, you know?
Exactly. You just outlined my life.
Yeah. I feel that. I think most creatives struggle with that, from writers to, you know, I've been on a bunch of writing projects in the past, or, you know, even working with some things that I'm like, I just can't get feedback out. I can't get the words to explain what I need to do. I just need to talk to this dog for 10 minutes.
Yep.
And you got to tell him why he's the scruffiest dog in the house right now, and then I'll get back to it.
Do you have groups of, I mean, maybe they don't write the same thing, but you've got professional friends, right?
Yeah, people
that, okay, so exactly, we're going to go right back to that point of community. Having that professional community or journeyman community, wherever you are in your skill set, is terribly useful, because just like that beautiful dog who will look at you as you say, you know, you're the scruffiest animal here, and they just go, and you know, you're gonna feed me and you're gonna scratch my belly and you're gonna love it
and I'm gonna love it. Yeah, I mean I've even seen that in writing flavor text too, because, you know, sometimes you'll get in the file early and you'll look at a card and you'll know what kind of card it is and what kind of name it's supposed to have, but for the love of God, you just cannot, for whatever reason, come up with something that sticks or that feels like it fits whatever that particular card is. And you'll just be waiting for something that'll kind of like allow you to come up with your own ideas. And sometimes that happens when, you know, another writer comes in and they write something and you can do a riff off of that, or that kind of like sparks, you know, an idea. But it also is when the sketch comes in, when that first initial concept of what the artist is trying to do on the mm-hmm. card, like a lot of times I feel like that alone is enough for me to immediately go, yeah, I know exactly what this is going to be called.
So you find a symbiosis then, there's really a relationship between you and the artist then.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I think it has to do with, for me, ever since I've been a kid, I've always been a huge fan of concept mm-hmm. art in general, because to me, I feel like that is like raw creative process right there. Like it's literally like a sketchbook. I have an idea in my head. I'm getting it onto paper. It hasn't been processed by anyone yet. It hasn't had anyone come in and say, oh, I don't like this here. Let's move this over there, you know, whatever. And this and the other thing, it's just someone's idea, they put it onto paper. It's almost like when you're like a musician and you come up with a guitar mm-hmm. riff and you just write it down really fast. It's not a song yet. It's just an idea yeah. of a song. Yeah. And I just, that just for me was always something that I was really interested in. And I don't know, I guess now when I go to write, as soon as I see that, I just feel like I'm on that page a lot more than when I just had the filler image for weeks and weeks and weeks.
It also makes me think of music. Would you say that flavor text has elements of poetry to it? Because
absolutely.
You've got such a constrained space within which to work. You've got to come up with the distilled essence of whatever it is you're trying to say, right?
Yeah, yeah, and Matt Cavada actually said this best. Oh man, this is a long time ago now, but he said that like flavor text, it's not trying to make, you know, a simple idea sound really flowery and beautiful. It's more trying to take the most complex ideas that you can and distill them down into like their bare essence, just so you can fit it on one line, because that's really all you have.
There you go.
And it's tough. It's especially, you know, card after card after card, and like, but it's so much fun. I love it. I could do it all day.
Right on.
All right, and I got a question for you. So occasionally we have some new artists that or people interested in getting to this more creative aspect and ask us some things about, well, how do you get started in this sort of thing? And for us, you know, there's a 5,000 different ways, sure. But one thing that's caught my eye recently is art books. Mm-hmm. And the proliferation of people making worlds. For Peter Morbacher, for example, is Angelarium, which is super damn cool.
Yes, it is.
It's so cool. It's
really, really, really cool.
This idea of art book used to be, you know, you had to go to a convention, and that's the only place you could get this small print run Donato art book. And now it's almost overwhelming on what you can choose. So I'm curious, what's caught your eye lately, or what's something you would recommend that anyone looking into concept art, like the real raw thing, not just the concept art from X movie book, what would be something that, you know, you may keep as a reference guide, or you look into a lot as, hey, this is a neat thing that you have on your wall?
Okay, I would say you can guarantee it's going to stick in my imagination. And I'm going to want the book, and I'm going to go back to the book over and over again. If it's an idea that's got the cake, not just the icing.
Okay.
A lot of concept art that is coming out today, and this is, I'm going to go ahead and toss my opinion out here, and so it's, you know, it's worth about as much salt you can grab a hold of, but
okay.
A lot of it looks alike to me. Part of that is a push in the industry that is coming from the business side. Things need to happen fast. And there are certain techniques that permit you to move very fast and get the idea down. But I think some of it is, in a way, it's an unexpected consequence of having such a huge online community to pull from. People are readily cleaving to a given look or given style of concept art, and everyone goes flocking after that. Super realistic stuff would be an example of the kind of stuff that's out there. It's like, oh my God, no brush strokes. It's got to look, you know, like it's 100% realistic.
Okay. The hyper real movement of new video game art or...
Things
you can't differentiate from each other, like Eastern European fairy tales. Like, you see it, and you're like, yep, that's what it is. Totally get it. Yeah. And now it's like, I can't tell if this person made concept art for the movie Alien and they're Russian or South American. I can't really tell anything other than it looks like that.
You are having – one of the things that's happening is you're having everyone diving into this internet world that has – which I keep referencing because it's the world's biggest library ever. Nothing has ever been created in human history that's like this thing. And it gives everybody immediate access or near immediate access to an enormous backlog of images, which I think causes whatever is the latest zeitgeist, the latest look, really,
right,
to easily predominate. Suddenly everybody wants to chase that thing. Well, what they don't realize when they're doing it is, well, I'm going to double back as an example. H.R. Giger changed Alien. That film would not have been anything like it was if Giger had not been part of that project. Not just because he is an incredible painter, or was an incredible painter. He brought the whole life cycle of the alien to that movie. Dan O'Bannon and Donald Trussett did not come up with that. Giger did.
Right.
now you've got generations of people who have looked at that and they're feeding off of it. So you're getting a copy now of a copy of a copy of an alien, as opposed to the person, H.R. Giger, who went, what would make a really scary alien creature? I know, I'm going to go to a very specific part of the insect world, parasitic wasps.
Okay.
And check out how they do their thing. And the way they do their thing is, this is Darwin is said to have remarked when studying these creatures that God had a really cruel sense of humor. Because the wasps that parasitize caterpillars and parasitize spiders, in the case of the spiders, they paralyze them. And then they lay their eggs on them. And then the eggs hatch. And they eat the living spider until they're ready to go. So imagine being paralyzed. But that doesn't mean you can't feel pain. Feel right. Pain just fine.
You just can't do anything
about it. As these things spend a couple weeks eating you up. That's horrifying. But you're not going to get that idea just by looking at other people's art. You need to go out into the world and research things. So getting back to your question. One, most important thing you can do, read. Books. Read everything. Read about biology. Read about botany. Read about...
That seems to be a major theme. I mean, from what I've heard is you might have had a nickname. It might have had to deal with trees.
Oh, my God.
You might have been the tree boy.
I was the tree boy. In part because, I mean, what does everybody want to do? In concept art, the Holy Grail is character design. Everybody wants to do character design. And I don't blame them. It's the highest profile thing you can do. Well, when I came onto the project, Anson and Mark had already designed all the characters. And there was a ton of other stuff that needed building, and I happen to love buildings. Speaking of buildings, I happen to love architecture. I love anthropology. I love archaeology, astronomy, geology. I love marine biology. I love all this stuff. I want to know how things became they are, the way they are.
Arts education in a nutshell. Like, every college should be, like, grabbing you right now and being like, yes!
Oh, feed me, man. Feed me. I mean, I moved, and I'm not kidding, I moved a ton of books up here. 2,000 pounds of reference books.
Oh my God.
I have a reference library that will keep me warm and dry when I'm living on the street in my 70s. I'll just be able to pile it up around me. But I've got a whole section just on housing.
But that's something that's – it's not an art book. It's not like you're saying, what's this new art world? You're like, no, man, I'm going to see what churches were like in Poland because I'm going to use that for a project. And people are like, why would you do that? Because they're like, because they're cool. And
yeah, for example, have you heard of an anthology, a movie anthology called The Memory of Memories?
No.
Okay, it was created in the mid to late 90s. One of the people who did a segment was a gentleman named Otomo, who you might know his work through Akira.
It's an anime.
Yes. And he did a section, a sequence, a little story called Compass Rose, I think it was called.
Magnetic Rose.
Magnetic Rose, thank you. Which had, for its time, the most expensive sequence of animation ever shot in the history of animation. But it's worth mentioning, that's why I'm going here, because one of you mentioned churches. Why would you want to study churches? Well, because the environment of that world, Magnetic Rose, was designed around a church. And there are at least two other anime I can think of right off the top of my head where the spaceships are designed to look like cathedrals.
I mean, Warhammer 40K is basically Gothic churches everywhere.
Oh, good Lord, yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And Vampire Hunter D, Bloodlust.
Yeah.
The big spaceships for the vampires were gigantic Gothic cathedrals. You need to know this stuff to be able to make a rich world. And if you are going to go into the world of concept art, I think the best thing that you can do right now is thoroughly explore the world and your own imagination and make your own things.
Okay, so...
Peter Parker is the perfect example of this with his Angelarium.
Do you think people like Noah Bradley, while his ideas and bravado are abundant, his ability to say, you know what's more important than going to art school is learning reference in traveling. If you've never seen a mountain, you can't paint a mountain.
That's right. You can't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
So go to museums, go to parks, go to galleries. I mean, if you really want to know how to paint an animal and you live in Seattle, go to the Burke Museum. The downstairs is filled with taxidermy.
And as artists, usually you can ask to say, and I know this, I worked in an art museum, and whenever there's an artist that said, hey, we know, or I know you have a sculpture in the basement of blah thing. Can I set up an appointment and draw it during dusk? And what do people say in a museum? Hell yeah, of course. Exactly. And you come by in like 2 days?
That blew me away the first time Mike told me that was even possible. Because nobody tells you that. Like, how would I even know
that? You wouldn't. You know, that's the problem. And part of it is also being over here. Because over here, people just, they often don't think about that, right? But in Europe, everybody does that. Yeah. It's just a given. You know, you go to, the Louvre or the Prado, and you will see people painting.
There's always people painting.
Yep. And there's another thing. Go into museums and study the work of the masters, the people who really knew how to draw and how to paint. Those are the people, if you're going to study artists, go there. And, you know, great example of why, you know, if that's something you should do, look at the work of Moby Frank, look at the work of Jamie Jones, look at the work of Donato Giancola. Who did Donato study? People like Rossetti, people like Waterhouse. Who did Jamie Jones study? Bouguereau. Who did Moby Frank study? Who does he love? J.C. Leyendecker. Yep. So they all can reference actual painters who could paint like nobody's business.
Yeah, and then this art isn't like 15 pieces like Vermeer. I mean, you can go to most museums and say, hey, can I see some of your Hudson Gallery artists? And they're like, oh yeah, we have like six of them. You want to see
them? Absolutely.
It's always so strange. And people are so excited to be like, ooh, yeah, well, we'll put it up for you. We'll bring a juice or, you know, whatever they need.
You're seeing a bit of history. You're seeing a bit of magic, because that really is seeing a painting in person is incomparable to any other way of viewing it. It just it can be life changing.
It's like reading a Dante's Inferno in like the original Italian, and you're like, oh my God, this is so much better.
Yes, or Cervantes.
In Spanish, it's funny. It's really funny.
It's got to be an incredible experience, because you get inferences that, I mean, this is something that, and I do not speak another language, although I pretend to. I can mess around in Spanish and French, but it still blows me away that there are whole ways of thinking that are expressed in Spanish or in German or in Dutch that you can't express in English, and vice versa.
Right.
That we're that creative as a species that we can, even though we have this common thing called language, we can come up with totally different ways of looking at parts of the world or ways of thinking that can only be expressed in that language. That's, to bring it full circle, that's your challenge in the 21st century as an aspiring concept artist. Everyone can learn how to paint if they're willing to throw the time into the process.
Right.
Really dive in. What do you have to say as an artist? That's where your longevity is going to be as a creative. And that's where the thing that's the most important gift you have to give to the world resides. What do you have to say?
It's almost like anybody can make an angelarium of a bunch of angelic beans, neat. But why? What's the purpose? What's the background?
Yep.
And having this depth is, oh, this is a personal project. Can you imagine if you hook this person into a movie or whatever and then put three brilliant people next to them and then it's just, my God. It's like a rainbow comes out of their ears.
Absolutely. Right. I would not be surprised if Angelarium gets this guy movie gigs.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised at all if it gets Peter Morbacher movie gigs. Mm. And that's another reason to do these personal projects. You will grow in ways that, and you know, the industry will cause you to grow too, but you're going to grow in ways that the industry won't, because it's going to be totally self-fueled. You are going to want to pursue things that aren't potentially ever going to be monetarily viable.
All right, well then, Ant, let's ask you this.
Yes.
Do you have a personal project in the works? Beyond your, you know, you might have something that you have Kickstarter and being paid for under NDA. Do you have a personal work? Do you find time for that?
I have actually changed my life so that rather than spending the majority of my time working in the industry, I'm spending the majority of my time working on my personal stuff, because I've got 25 years of stories, characters, and worlds that I have put aside so that I can make a career.
So you put them on the put nuggets in the back burner, threw them in a book, and just kind of been marinating.
Journals upon journals and sketchbooks upon sketchbooks.
Right.
I now have a Patreon account, and this year I am working on a novel, and it will be an illustrated novel, so I'll also be doing the illustrations for it, and I'm doing the world building for it. So you'll get to see the environments as I come up with them, the creatures as I come up with them.
That sounds cool.
What's the genre?
Genre is Lovecraftian horror.
Oh, wow. I'm picking that up.
Yes.
Immediately. It was like you literally could not have said anything better at all.
Yes.
At all.
It's are you familiar with Hammer films? Like the earlier Hammer films are like The Fall of the House of Usher, The Monster Must Die.
It's Hammer Film Productions. Yeah, there's like it's Hammer a full films. Production company. They make tons of friggin' movies.
Yeah, and they were I won't say that they were a schlock studio, but they were.
They made some cheesy crap back in the 70s.
That's true. It's
you
true.
Know?
But they also made some really fun films like Caedermass and the Pit, which is a very Lovecraftian film for its time. But it has they're mostly period films.
They also made Night of the Living Dead. I mean, they've made seminal movies.
Okay.
True, true. They also made another one that I have not yet seen called Wakewood. Let me tell you the premise. The premise is a couple lose their child to a dog attack, and they are introduced to the concept that by certain nefarious people that if you do a certain thing in a certain place, you can have your daughter back for 3 days. Turns out not to have been a good idea.
Yeah, sure, shocker.
Yeah, but they make that kind of film, right? And
that's like almost the reverse of what's that Lovecraft one where the town comes in and they kill the cats and then the cats end up eating people.
Ulfar.
Yeah, cats.
Yes.
Oh, that's
such a good story. Yes. It's so it just leaves that idea. He doesn't even write that happens. He just plants. It's almost like Inception. Like, I'm not going to tell you the cats ate anybody, but you're going to think it.
Pardon
well,
me.
The cats
what's that?
And that's it. People. Totally.
Yeah.
All right. So, so this project you have going seems super cool. Super freaking cool. Lovecraftian things. Horror clearly is going to be into some of this. Super.
Oh, yes.
How is it in the process? Did it just start? Has it been going a little while?
The Patreon campaign is maybe about 2 weeks old.
Oh, it's brand new.
It's brand new. I have released several pages from my sketchbook of monster designs for not only the world of this book, but this book is actually a prequel to a series of books that I want to jump to next. In this instance, the novel in question is at 108,000 words, and I think it's going to top out at about 150. And
oh my gosh! Oh wow!
It's going to be broken up into three parts, so it's going to be, you know, you figure at this point we're talking a book that will get edited to about 250, 280 pages, maybe 300. I'm guessing, having never written a novel, all of this is up for grabs. But this will be, if things work out well, this will be the first section of three books, and I'm aiming for a release of the text around the end of October and an illustrated version by the Christmas of this year.
That's super great. Well, okay, so other than Patreon, we're going to post the link to it. They can get a hold of you there.
We're definitely going to promote that. Yeah, mostly because if that comes out, which I'm very excited about, by Christmas, then I will also get a new Star Wars movie. And I'll get this new book, and I will be very happy.
That's freaking great.
Right on.
Well, with that, we'll let you go for the night. I mean, we never want to have everything be exhaustive, because, you know, we'd love to have people back on in the future, you know, maybe 4 months down the road, 5 months down the road. You're like, look at all this cool crap I got now. And I'll be like, yeah, let's see it. Tell us another story. Like, I'm all about that. That's so freaking
absolutely
cool. I mean, but Ant, we didn't even talk about Phyrexians.
Oh my God, we didn't talk about Phyrexians.
No, there's a lot of really, like, stuff that
we got to do a part two. We'll do a part two.
That would be awesome. I am totally down for that.
Oh,
has to be a part two. God knows, I'm sure he has art just laying around his house in coasters and pants out of, and he's like, oh, I got this other one right here.
Doing laundry, like, oh, I forgot about this concept art.
Yeah, I forgot about this page.
That's strange. I don't remember putting it there.
I look forward to that. And do keep us abreast of things. We know you're very active on Twitter. Whenever people, like, interact or add you, you post, like, it's almost like a circus game. You're like, okay, I'm all smart. Like, blah, and it's like, whoa. So, like, never was so before seen peace. Like, someone just pokes you with a stick, and it's just overwhelming. So I can't even imagine what this Patreon is going to come with, but
Toon art comes out. Yep. I want to thank people for following me, and that just seems like the easiest and most enjoyable.
No one does that.
And there is so much concept art to be shared. I mean, there are some folks, like a lot of the people who work for places like DreamWorks and Sony, some of their work may get put into books, but the rest of it, those guys work under draconian rules, and their work is it's unlikely that that work will get shared anytime in the next 20 years.
Right. Or ever.
But with magic, we get to share this stuff. And I think it would be a really cool thing if all the folks who have done this work, Todd and, the list is huge. The list is absolutely huge.
There's dozens and dozens of people that have been on design pushes to, you know what, as much as it is a part of the industry today that people are assimilating to a style, I get it. Like, we can't ignore it, and it is best to learn from the field. But you know what? If I want to learn how to draw a dragon, Todd Lockwood's pretty damn good.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe Ciruelo Cabral is the only guy who can get close to him. But to me, and, you know, Ciruelo, I love Ciruelo's work. But right. Todd's dragons have always had a place in my heart. And that place is well defended.
And, I mean, you can see concept art that there is a need. There is a desire from... Yeah. Not only, you know, in the video game world and whatever to make books, but of magic variety of too. You can put card art in books, sure, fine. But some of that concept, that grittiness to say, this is how we made Innistrad. This is how we made Phyrexians. Oh, Scott Waters has like 30 pages you could tell him about trees. You want to learn about trees? He's going to tell you everything. Like, that's the type of things that, you know, gets artists thinking, oh, it's not just deciduous forest, white wizard, pointy hat.
Right.
Ah, oh, there's some snow on the ground. Like, no, there's a whole ecosystem. And
yeah, man.
It's sometimes hard to get that across.
Right. The world is bottomless. The world is, the possibilities are endless. You just got to be willing to stretch your imagination and take a few risks. The worst that can happen is people go, eh, I don't really like it.
Right.
And move on to the next thing.
Right. It's better. That's better than just being mediocre the entire time, right? If you have 10 things that fail and that one thing that is new and interesting and like really grabs people's attention, then that's, I would argue, better than having 10 things that are just like, yeah, that was nice, I guess.
Yeah, God, we've got enough mediocrity.
Yeah.
There's enough things that are fine.
Yeah, we don't need more vanilla, man.
Yeah, don't need that.
No.
All right, Ann, well, we'll let you go. We can find you online. We'll post your links below. I'm at Morthos Mike. You can find me on the Twitters. I'm an easy Google search away. And with me always, my boy, the secondary ant.
Twin ant. My twin.
Twin ant. Double ant. It could be a hashtag. Thanks so much for listening today, and we hope you stop by again soon.
Yep.
Take care, guys. It was a total pleasure.